Call Senate Hess to order on the 20th of April, about 1:38. Senators Green, Elton, and Dyson are here. Our first order of business today is House Bill 185. I hope we can move that. Then we will take up Senate Bill 162, and we may or may not, depending on, please, the wish of a few people, hold 177 over for next session. Sir.
For the record, my name is Eric DeLaren. I'm a staff member for Representative Mike Chenault, and we lovingly refer to this bill as the Ryan Colton Bill. He was a 19-year-old university student, and he woke up with what he thought was the flu. By 3 a.m., he was in the hospital. By 5 a.m., he was on life support and blind. And when they medevaced him to Seattle, he was brain dead by that point. Meningococcal virus and bacterial diseases have a 15% mortality rate. And if it's not terminal, it results in loss of limbs, blindness, or problems with major organs. What this bill does is removes the exemption so post-secondary institutions shall provide information about viral and bacterial meningococcal viruses or diseases, and offer immunization options. The students will sign a document saying they've received this, and this at least gets the public informed when they're in a situation of high amounts of people in a small area, which is where this disease breeds and spreads quickly. That's it.
This all has a familiar ring to me. Senator Elton.
Mr. Chair, it does have a familiar ring, and I appreciate the work that has been done on the House side with the bill. My staff has been working on this issue for a while, but for us it was a concept. For Representative Chenault and the people in his office that have been working on this. Unfortunately, it went far beyond being a concept, and the reality of it has been pretty devastating to a family in their district. So I appreciate the work that they have done on it, and I'm prepared to move the bill when you're done with public testimony.
Would you tell me again why the institutions and stuff all involved can't do all these very reasonable things now?
They can, but they're exempt, so they don't. Plain and simply.
Dr. Mangs, Monsager? Is that true?
I think they could require an immunization without.
We're not asking for a requirement. Okay.
They could go quite. I'm just saying they could go even much further than this without anything done in statute.
Sir.
For the record, my name is Dr. Monsager. Dr. Beth Funk, our chief of epidemiology, is on the line too, in case she's more knowledgeable about this than I am. But my initial comment, I think the question has to do is that colleges don't require this at this point. I think it's variable. Most colleges in the incoming freshmen now are including information. You should get a meningococcal immunization or tell us that you're not. I have a son who's a college freshman. He got that from his college outside. But you are correct. It's not a mandate at present that they have that information. I think most colleges have moved in that direction voluntarily.
Okay. And this requires Alaska institutions to do so?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Dr. Funk?
Yes.
Dr. Funk, can you hear us?
Yes, this is Dr. Funk online.
Yeah, thank you. This is Chair Dyson. What is there about the college environment that makes it such a unique danger zone for this problem?
Well, there's not good hard data on it, but it's presumed that that people are living in very close quarters. It's similar to if this particular bacteria also has caused problems in military army barracks, for example, in the past. And so whenever people live in very close quarters, so that if they have a cough or sneeze, it's easy for other people to breathe in the germs, then this is a setup for that.
All right. I assume you approve of this legislation?
Well, we certainly support vaccines. This particular bacterial infection, we're neutral on it, and the reason we are is because in Alaska, the strain of meningococcal disease that we see is not covered in the vaccine. Unfortunately, that particular strain they have not found an effective vaccine for. So while we don't have strong feelings against this legislation, we aren't certain that it will have a big impact on public health at this point in time. The other thing just to be aware of is that a new meningococcal vaccine has just been released, and although it doesn't cover the strain of bacteria that causes most meningococcal disease in Alaska, it is now going to be required for all 11 and 12-year-olds and are recommended for all 11, 12-year-olds and 15-year-olds and college students, freshmen. So there is going to now be a national recommendation from the CDC, and it will be required, we will be required as a state to administer it to children who are eligible through Vaccine for Children funding, federal funding. So a lot of children in Alaska are going to automatically be getting this vaccine in the next year, in the foreseeable future. So most kids will probably already be vaccinated in the next few years when they do attend college.
Any other questions for Dr. Funk? Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Green.
Yeah, Beth, are there any other diseases, syndromes, or whatever that rise to the level of this particular one that occur in Alaska?
You mean as far as causing meningitis and the severity of the disease?
No. Anything non-meningitis, any other syndrome or any disease that's out there that is not currently, there's no vaccine that's regularly given or there's no instruction. I was just wondering, I know one of my kids caught coccidiomyosis or valley fever right before he went to college, and I don't know how, I don't think that's that terribly contagious, but I was just thinking he was terribly ill. But are there any other diseases, though, that come to a college campus more often or to an army barracks or a dormitory setting that are similar to this? Or is this the only one? Or is meningitis sort of in a class by itself?
Well, it is in a class by itself. Nothing else is coming to mind. I mean, there's certainly less serious illnesses like influenza and other things that are spread by the respiratory tract or tuberculosis, but that's much rarer. Okay. I can't really think of anything that would meet the same criteria. I don't know if Dr. Monsager has any thoughts on that or not.
Thank you.
Any other questions or discussion? Senator Elton.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 185. Is there a fiscal note, Eric? With the fiscal note, if there is one, Mr. Chair. With a zero fiscal note.
Objections? Seeing none, House Bill 185 moves from committee.
Thanks, Eric.
Next, we're going to deal with Senate Bill 162.
Good
Thank you, Senator Dyson, members of the committee. I feel like I've been here numerous times this session. This might be
delighted.
This might be the last time, conceivably.
Your new best friends.
Let me set a little bit of the framework here. My first couple of years here, I worked on a bill that we call student or school behavior and safety standards. And that required that every school district go through some process to get agreement with the community and parents about what the behavior and safety standards would be in the school, and that they publish that so that parents and staff would know what the standards are. And it said that if a teacher enforced the standards by the pre-agreed discipline procedure, there could be no action against the teacher. So it was designed to get community and parent buy-in and to protect teachers. It is our experience 5 years later, looking at the record that the Department of Education has, that it appears that not a lot of schools are going through a very rigorous process to do that. Some of the schools have submitted paperwork that is an exact copy of what another district has done, misspellings and bad grammar transmitted from one to another, and we Mariners would call that the things being gun decked, but or pencil whipped or something. Anyways, so incorporated in the bill before you is a little bit more stringent requirements that the school safety and behavior standards be a little more rigorous. In addition, we've all been seeing lots of information in the national and local media, both popular and medical, about the problem of obesity. So not knowing how to attack the problem in the best way, I learned a long time ago that evil and bacteria grow in the dark, and one way to get started is to find out what the problem is and drag it out in the light. So that's what got us started thinking about having some way of defining how big the problem is, no pun intended, and have some way of defining the obesity. All we legislators have the opportunity to go through the health fair every spring, and if you agree, they will measure you and weigh you and tell you what your BMI is. And so, anyways, that was the genius of our thinking. And we started talking with Dr. Monsager and others, and I believe it's fair to say that Dr. Monsager and department believes that there are more public purposes that get served by what we're trying to do here. Am I right, sir?
Thank you, Senator Dyson. What I would like to do is take an opportunity in commenting on this bill to just put establish for the record some of the data we know about our state, and also to put in context some of the discussions that led in the background to a particular part of this bill dealing with obesity. Last summer, we as a state applied and were accepted into Policy Academy of the National Governors Association. We were one of seven states this year, and looking at prevention and secondary prevention of chronic diseases in our state. The governors obviously got interested in this subject because of cost and Medicaid. So we as a team put ourselves together last fall. We needed to invite legislators, so we invited Senator Dyson to join the team as a member of the Senate. The team, as we now are several months later, has come to believe that obesity is one of the underlying causes of a great deal of both the present and future cost in the Medicaid program and other part costs to our state. So with that as kind of a prologue, let me just quickly step through some of the slides in the typical way I've come here as a committee before. I've brought some slides and then comment just a little bit on the bill and what a little bit about what I know is going on in other states around these questions. I think you have these handouts in front of you, and I'm not going to read everything you can read. I'm going to just comment on a few of the slides. So the purpose here is to talk just for a few minutes about the scope of the problem in Alaska, health impacts and economic consequences, and I think this is something that gets disconnected too often, that the health and economic consequences don't get linked. And then what are some of the ideas that are circulating across the country in terms of ideas for prevention? Page 2, how big is our problem in Alaska? It's really an incredibly rapidly spreading epidemic. From a pediatrician's point of view, it's amazing to me in the 25 years since I finished my pediatric residency, the change in kids, both in our state and in the other places I've worked in our country. These next three slides on page 2 and 3 just show you, and going over to page 4, how quickly the color of the country is changing in terms of weight. And when you think that these slides just start in 1991, go up to 2003, the change in our country is just amazing. I don't think that we as physicians have seen this kind of a change in any recent phenomenon going on in our country. If these trends continue on the next 20 years, we're going to see most of the states being red, to use the color that's on the top of page 4, and whereas just some of them are today. Our state has rapidly moved from this pale blue to yellow and will be red in the very near future. The slide at the bottom of page 4 talks about high school kids from the 2003 data. And in pediatrics, instead of using the word with kids, instead of using the word obesity, we use overweight and at risk for overweight. And you can see the data there that how many of our high school kids are overweight or at risk for overweight. Combined, it's over 40% by the time they leave high school.
Oh, that. So the bar graph at the bottom of page 4, the bars on the far right are just the summation of the two,
right.
The other two.
That's correct.
All right.
Page 5, you saw last fall the data from the Anchorage School District. We've been working with the Anchorage School District for the last 5 years, and these next couple pages are just a summary of the data, of the kids' data we know from Anchorage School District, and I think that this data will probably be replicated in other school districts when school districts choose to do this. The first slide at the top of page 5 shows the combined data from 5 years, 1998 to 2003. The good news is in gray, 62% of kids are normal weight. The bad news is 36% are overweight or at risk for overweight in the Anchorage School District. The other thing that the bottom of page 5 shows that this is not just a school's problem. This is a community, this is a family issue, this is a behavior issue, that 32% of kids are starting school heavy. And that is just an amazing change from 25 years ago. Page 6 shows the change over just this 5 years, that the number of kids that are normal weight reduced from 65% to 60% in just 5 years. And if we think about what the next 20 years are going to bring, you can extrapolate in your own mind where we're going to be. The bottom of page 6 shows the, again, this is Anchorage School District kids, and this is what happened. If you were normal weight in 98-99, did you stay there? And you can see that 80% stayed there, but 20% increased weight. Almost nobody went down. Well, what do we know about adults in Alaska? Page 7, this shows data for the last 10 years, and it's just a steadily slow ramp up as the years go by with adult data. If you extrapolate the Anchorage School District data that I've seen for the subsection of high school at the end of high school and put it on the beginning point of this graph, you have almost a linear rate uphill from the high school years going into adult years and just continuing on. Well, we adults in America have come up with lots of ways to decrease our physical activity. In some respects, one person said, we're trying to undo 50 years of progress. Everything we've done since World War II in our country in one way or another has been about labor-saving devices. And so we've got a lot of behaviors we have built into our lifestyles, and these just kind of dramatically show some of the ways we adults choose not to exercise. Page 8, what do we know about Alaska adults in terms of nutrition and physical activity? 40%+ don't meet recommendations for physical activity. Only 23% consume the recommended amounts of fruits and vegetables. And as you've seen the data about nutrition, there's lots of discussion these days about how do we show the nutrition pyramid better, how do we get Americans to eat more bulky foods and less calorie-dense foods.
What do we know about high school activity or physical activity in high school kids at the bottom of page 8? 27% don't meet the CDC minimum recommendations for physical activity. In other words, they're not moving more than 30 minutes a day. 28% are watching 3 or more hours of TV. One of the things that's not shown on any of these slides is the linkage between hours of TV or video games and weight. There's a very strong correlation between TV, playing video games. In other words, not much physical activity and gaining weight. Page 9, we supersize all of our portion sizes, kids and adults. The more food is being prepared and consumed outside the home. I think I've seen data that in most families now, 1 out of 3 meals is prepared food outside the home. In urban centers, one of the issues is grocery stores have exited from urban centers. Thankfully, we're not in a state where that's a big problem, and the conversion has been to fast food outlets and mini marts and so on that mostly has processed foods. Another thing, as a pediatrician, the ads that are shown on TV time, if you go and turn on any kids' TV on Saturday morning, half of the ads are for food stuff, and it's all processed food. I've seen another statistic that in an average hour of kids' TV in the morning, there are 11 food ads in that hour's time period. And it becomes then a very mixed issue, is if you want to keep even good shows like some of the PBS shows or so on, the underwriting from the food industry is immense. So it's going to be a big issue for us as a country is how to deal with it. What do we know about Alaska schools? Bottom of page 9. Good news is over half of the schools make fruits and vegetables available every day. 80% have water, milk, or 100% fruit juice available. 28% do prohibit soda being available during lunch. This is one of the changes that many communities, or some communities across the country, are starting to do. And a small minority of schools have established vending machine policies, and I think we're all seeing this is at least is up for discussion in communities all over our state and the country is, should there be local community policies as to what's sold. One of the changes that's coming on page 10 is the Federal WIC Reauthorization Act of 2004. It's not implemented yet. The implementation date, the schools are waiting for regulations. My understanding is the 2006-2007 year is expected to be the implementation date, and it has another mandate for schools in it. And it's interesting it was put in the WIC law, and this is what's in the law there that you can see in yellow. Their schools are going to have to develop wellness policies that include goals for nutrition education, physical activity, that include nutrition guidelines for foods available, and establish a plan for measuring implementation of the wellness policy. That's what the law says. The regulations aren't out yet from the feds.
That's under WIC.
Mm-hmm. But it applies to schools.
Say it again.
Under WIC. That's women, infants, and children, and that's the program that generally provides food policies for
pregnant women.
My understanding is the leverage that was used is if you participate in the National School Lunch Program, that was the linkage in the federal law.
Senator Elton had a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Doctor, on the top slide on page 10, it seems to say that it requires schools individually and not districts. Is my assumption correct? Because the sponsor's bill does make a distinction between districts and schools. And I'm wondering if in fact WIC requires it by schools, whether or not it might not be best just to make sure that the reporting standards match.
That's a good point, and I don't know the answer. I can't remember. I don't have a copy of the act with me, and I can't remember whether. I guess I've been assuming that school districts could have wellness plans, but I don't remember. The law may say schools. We have to go look it up.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
I don't think the school would receive any funding if it weren't through the district and the nutritionist and the dietitian. I think it's school districts. And
that's my assumption too, but I'm not sure.
School's going to receive funding and the other school not in that district. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
So that's something I only put that in here for you to be aware of it.
Because next slide.
Yeah.
I might explain it.
Bottom of page 10.
I think we need to go check that Senator Elton's question, though, to be sure about that. And I only put this in here because, as one is, I don't think this has gotten lots of conversation yet, and I expect it's going to be starting. And two, there's the Fed. My sense is this discussion about wellness policies and so on is ratcheting up across the country at the community level and at the federal level.
I don't know if there are any nutritionists and dietitians online. I apologize for what I'm going to say. But I don't know how often you go to the school and eat the, you know, whatever is approved by the federal law and the district and everything. But I would say much of it would be very suspect in the menu, the treatment, the preparation. And so they may be piling onto a system that is not necessarily the base from which you want to begin.
Senator Green, I couldn't agree more. I think it may be piling onto a system that is reasonably broken. If I could just tell one vignette, I exercise when I'm in Anchorage with a guy who's one of the cafeteria managers at one of the elementary schools in Anchorage. And he's a chef in a past life, and he tried to work within the Anchorage School District. Last year, he got the kids really hooked into fresh salads, which took him a while. And then this year's menu choices didn't allow him that. He had to use the big cans of processed beans and so on. It took him 4 months to get the school district. He had to demonstrate wastage, throwing away and so on, that he could do it with salads and that the kids would eat it at the same cost. And so we have some institutional inertia that we'll have to change, too.
And then very often it goes back to the federal requirement that you use X number of components of this and this from their supply. So anyway, thank you, Ms. Sherman, for digressing.
Doc, I went to a presentation here a year or two ago just about dental health, particularly in rural communities and with mostly the impact with elementary children, you know, and it was pretty horrendous. In the national conversation that's going on about obesity of children, is there a parallel component talking about dental health?
Senator Dyson, absolutely. They're quite closely linked.
I think so.
Because with the soda addiction in our country, the amount of sugar that's in sodas and the acidity does very bad things to kids' mouths, in addition to giving lots of unnecessary calories. And so I think that's what's led into lots of places thinking about vending machine policies and so on in schools. But we need to change communities and families' behaviors. One other quick story, as a pediatrician, I've tried to convince kids that, one, drink water. And then if you won't drink water, if you have to flavor it, go to something like Crystal Light or something that flavors it without calories. If you won't do that, then how about no-calorie sodas? I can count on less than one hand the number of successes I've had. Teenagers won't drink zero-calorie sodas for reasons that we have a huge marketing and societal change in front of us. It's one of my failures as a pediatrician of convincing kids that that would be a useful change of taking some unnecessary calories out and protecting their mouths at the same time.
My oldest daughter has a foster daughter who is 8. And she has no front teeth. All the molars are caps. And for the first 4.5 months, tremendous gastric distress as she learned to adopt to a diet that wasn't Fritos and carbonated drinks and a lifestyle that wasn't sitting in front of the VCR. And just huge transitions. I'm sorry, you don't need my war stories, but.
Well, those are the behavior family changes, and this is mostly going to need to be an issue at family level because this is a behavior of how families live. Just a couple other slides and then I'll be done. Page 11 talks about the health consequences of being overweight, both as youth and as adults. For us as adults, we talk most often about diabetes, arthritis, from joints wearing out from weight, cardiovascular disease, and so on. Now, if you saw the Daily News this morning, or if you look at it later today, you'll see there's an article today about this article that was released yesterday.
in the Journal of the American Medical Association. There's a tremendous controversy going on among scientists as to what's the health cost of obesity. A year ago, the statement was being made that it was estimated to be the number two cause of death in America after tobacco. Last fall, there was a release of information from CDC that a lot of internal scientific argument, and they reduced the estimate from 400,000 people dying annually to 375,000 people. Now, this is published today, is from another group at CDC, and it lowers the estimate to 100,000. So I think the summary is nobody really knows the death consequence of obesity. We know a lot of the morbidity consequence from diabetes. We know a lot of the cost consequence with illness and drugs and so on. But as treatment gets better, say with cardiovascular disease and stroke prevention with aspirin and so on, the scientists are clearly having a lot of trouble sorting out what's the contribution of obesity to death compared to the other things that are going on and inactivity, et cetera.
Senator Elton.
Well, I mean, and Doctor, you can shake your head vehemently no if I'm wrong in what I say next, but I mean, we ought not be measuring only by number of people who die. We also need to measure the cost to government, to private corporations, and to others, the cost of treating the diseases so that people don't die.
I would agree 100% with what you're, and that was kind of my segue into where I wanted to go next, is death is one issue, but morbidity and cost to society, to business, to government is a very big and growing issue. If you use Alaska diabetes data just as an indicator on page 13, I'll jump ahead for just a second. We've got, and this is what happens to people that have diabetes is the top slide. What's the risk of having heart attacks or stroke? You can see the difference in having cardiovascular events if you have diabetes. And most diabetes, the type 2 diabetes we talk about, is weight related. Now, the kid diabetes, the skinny kids that we've heard about over the years, and I've taken care of as a pediatrician, type 1 diabetes, that's not weight-related, but most adult diabetes is weight-related. And then the bottom slide is looking at the cost to Medicaid over three fiscal years if you have diabetes and if you don't have diabetes, just to get a sense of the dollar impact to just the government payer part of this problem.
Probably obviously, in addition to all the medical costs and stuff, the folks become less and less productive, i.e. able to work, care for themselves or care for others, you know, and so.
Page 12, there's a slide there that tries to be an estimate looking at both Alaska data and U.S. data of the economic costs. And then the bottom of slide 12 just looks at some of the data of the increase in diabetes incidence in our state. And we, like all states in the country, are on just a steady ramp uphill with the diagnosis rate.
And then $240 million, you think, of our costs annually are related to obesity? Is that what top...
That's the estimate, yeah. And given the disagreements about the death consequence of obesity, I think I take all economic estimates also with some degree of it's in the ballpark, but don't hang your hat on this number is exactly definitive, would be my thought. Just another Medicaid fact. One out of every eight Medicaid dollars is going to people that have diabetes.
So... You know, as I've watched us get to the top of the list on child abuse, child sexual abuse and stuff, you know, part of it we've got to just realize is better reporting. Is that true with diabetes as well?
No.
The big jump in the last 10 years, we had just as accurate a reporting 10 years ago as we do now?
I would, with one caveat, the Medicaid data is the best and most complete we have. And that's drawn off of claims data paying for diagnoses. So if you assume the doctors are making diagnoses and making claims for codes are the same as 10 years ago, then I think it's valid data. And that's the assumption I would make. So then, that's all prologue to what does this bill have to do with prevention. So slide 14 at the bottom tries to summarize some of the prevention strategies that are being talked about across the country. One of them is requiring physical education in all school grades. As far as I know, there's only one, maybe there's two states in the country now that is true. Another is to regulate the nutritional content of food available to students in cafeterias, vending machines, and at school events. I don't know of any state that has taken on any state mandate, but clearly there's a great deal of local school district innovation and trials going on all over the country right now. California probably comes the closest as a state as they've regulated vending machine content during school hours across the state. Restricting advertising. This is in conversation. Sweden as a country is probably the most different from the United States in that they prohibit advertising for food during the hours that kids are most likely to be watching television, for example. So that's a national policy in Sweden. Implementing school policies that prohibit the use of food or physical activity as a punishment or reward. I've talked with my wife about this, who's a third grade teacher, and she has parties every so often when the kids have achieved reading or so on, and they usually involve food. And so we have had some active dialogue about this one, and she agrees with me about the fact that we don't need to do this on a regular basis, but I think she and I also agree that parties are important for kids' social well-being, and that's part of development too, but not every day. And then this last one, conduct annual height and weight screenings and make BMI for age results available to parents. Arkansas has gone the most its own way in the last 2 years. It's the only state I know of that has passed a law that implemented last spring, this is the second spring now, in which every kid in Arkansas school districts, 450,000 kids, gets an annual report to the parents about the body mass index of the kids. It goes home as a separate report to parents of where their kids are at. Anecdotally, Arkansas says it's leading to change in families' behavior, but it's the only state that has gone to that, has made that policy decision to date. Page 15, there's just some other ideas, zoning requirements to support physical activity, tax incentives for work sites that promote physical activity, healthy eating, requiring disclosure of nutritional content sold in restaurants. You've heard about these kinds of issues. Subsidizing the cost of nutritious foods. I heard an interesting idea. With the postal bypass system of shipping stuff to rural Alaska, that POP is heavy, saying, why don't we subsidize the shipping costs of healthier foods into rural Alaska as opposed to having a federal policy of subsidizing sodas, for example. I hadn't thought about that as a policy issue, but that's an interesting idea to float around for people to think about. And then the last few slides are just some, the next two slides, bottom of 15 and top of 16, are just some slides from our Policy Academy of the other issues. This clearly isn't the only strategy issue. We're trying to work and get more businesses involved in worksite involvement, trying to work with the school Department of Education. What else can we do around school wellness? The vision statement you can see at the top of page 16 from us as a team, this is the future that we would like to see, just as a group of about 15 of us, a state in which public and private partners work together to create an environment of healthy living where our diverse cultures and people strive to improve the lifelong health of all Alaskans, and you can read the rest of that. So what does SB 162 contribute to that if it were to be enacted? What it puts into place is if the legislature chooses to play, school districts would develop an average for the schools, and it would be depending, but you have to have enough kids so we can provide anonymity to the kids. And communities would then have data where they sit with their kids, and then they could use that information to develop their own school wellness policies that fit their local community needs. That's really the intent of this bill, as I see it, as the health part of it. There is one amendment that I would suggest be considered if this bill is to move, and that's on page 3 of the bill on line 29.
Second.
current statute says that the Department of Health and Social Services shall, and number two is train and certify public health nurses and school district employees to conduct hearing and vision screening tests. In fact, we aren't meeting that statute today. We are assisting school districts when requested to train and certify, but we are, or to assisting them to learn how to do it. We aren't certifying, and we don't clearly don't train everybody. So I would suggest we've submitted a zero fiscal note with the assumption that we can work out an understanding that the wording for that be changed to say assist the Department of Education Early Development in training school district employees. And that would be, if this bill is to move, that would be my suggestion for a change. With that, I think I've talked for long enough.
Doc, I'm sorry that my chief of staff, who has worked most on this bill, is on his way to Wisconsin, where he has a very ill father. So I'm a little bit playing catch up. But my understanding, my conversation with Wes, was that you had implied that schools that get busy about defining the size of their problem, no pun intended, and decide to do something about it, that there's a very significant possibility that grants or funds will be available for them to use to work the problem.
Senator Dyson, we have a proposal into Senator Stevens to enlarge our obesity program and would envision using that in part.
No pun intended again, right?
Right. Would envision using that at least in part in partnership with schools. What I think we've seen in Anchorage is the getting a school average BMI data available is precipitating the community to start talking. The school board met talking about this. The mayor's office and the school board in Anchorage is talking about a citywide task force looking at this as an issue. Money's going to be a big issue any way we cut it, because our country doesn't have a very good track record of putting money into prevention. And finding funds to make significant investments that way that pay off, well, let me say this again. One is finding money. Two is how do we know that when we make investments they have a return on investment? That's going to be the other challenge.
So getting the information on the BMI gives a baseline for them to decide where they have a problem and a baseline to evaluate the effectiveness of whatever they do. And having that baseline is going to help them sell or convince whoever the funding sources are that there's a problem here that needs to be.
And Senator Dyson, I would argue that it gives information to the community to decide what do we as a community want to do about this.
All right. Any other questions for Dr. Mansager right now? I got a couple of people that want to testify. Do you have anybody online? Anybody who, how many are here from the media, the press? One. I love it. All right. Beverly Smith.
You should have this in front of you, I think. Right. Okay. For the record, my name is Beverly Smith, and I am the Christian Science Committee on Publication for Alaska. And I thank you for allowing me the opportunity to offer comments on this bill. Just some background. In my capacity as Christian Science Committee on Publication for Alaska, one of my roles is to watch legislative proposals to ensure that Alaskans have the choice to pursue spiritual means for the prevention and cure of disease, and that includes Christian Science treatment and care. And so in looking at SB 162, the Committee on Publication for Alaska respectfully requests an amendment, and it would be on page 3, the same one that same area that Dr. Mansager was referring to, and it would be adding a part C, and that would say, notwithstanding A of this section, a person required to conduct a test or cause a child to receive a vision, weight, height, and hearing screening examination under this section is exempt from this requirement if the parent or guardian of the child objects to the testing procedure on the grounds that the procedure conflicts with the religious tenets and practices of the parent or guardian. The parent shall sign a statement that the parent knowingly refuses the examination, and the person conducting the test or causing a child to receive an examination shall have a copy of this signed statement retained in the school records. And the explanation for my offering this amendment is that it would clarify that parents who use prayer and spiritual means for the care and the healing of their children may choose to object to a vision, weight, height, and hearing screening examination. Christian Science is one of the religious non-medical forms of treatment that relies on spiritual means through prayer to heal illness, injuries, and other conditions. In Alaska, individuals have chosen Christian Science treatment and care for healing for about 100 years. The experience of those practicing Christian Science is that this healing method has both preventative and curative effects. And the application of this religious non-medical method of healing does not involve any type of medical examination or screening. Parents who rely on prayer or spiritual means for healing should be allowed to object to a vision, weight, height, and hearing screening examination for the benefit of their children. In House Bill 109, relating to the testing of hearing on newborns, which is currently in the House Rules Committee, it contains similar language allowing parents to object in writing if the procedure conflicts with the religious or other tenets and practices of the parent. Therefore, we respectfully request that this bill be amended as stated above. And I'd just like to add one other thing that when I heard Dr. Monzinger talk about Arkansas, that was we did look at the Arkansas bill, and it does contain, or the law, it does contain this accommodation. So thank you for allowing me this time.
You're welcome. That's fascinating, and I appreciate it. Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman Beverly. This may demonstrate my lack of knowledge about your faith, but I guess I had assumed that that testing would be okay, but enforced treatment might not be. And I think I'm hearing you say no, that that testing also would contravene basic principles of your faith.
Through the chair, to answer this, I would say that the care of children and any individuals under Christian Science is purely spiritual. And so then even an examination would, I suppose, enter, would put forth some physical characteristics, physical results, something physical to deal with. And certainly there are many Christian Scientists who would say, examination, that's not a problem for me, I'll just do it. It's, you know, and certainly when it's required by law, it's done. But I guess here it would be just having the choice. And so I don't know how many would take that option. But because of the nature of Christian Science care is purely spiritual, generally wouldn't have an examination.
If I could, and again, Beverly, I, sure. I just this is a learning experience for me.
That's
but
good.
It would seem to me that testing could give information to the family on whether or not to direct spiritual care based on the results of the testing.
And that would be the curative portion. But the preventative, I think, is also very important and spiritual. And all the time I was growing up, we had these little exemption cards that my parents could fill out, but that didn't mean that they were abrogating their responsibility, and they prayed daily for me, and I feel that my health was a result of that, and I did not have any examinations or inoculations or any of that while I was growing up, so it was their choice.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Are you all, as a faith, as an organization, trying to get these kind of opt-out clauses in state laws across the nation.
Yes.
Okay, and I appreciate that. Senator Green?
I was just going to say that, Mr. Chairman, that over time, the school has, for many people, become the doctor's office. The nurse's office has become the medical thing. And so for people who prefer not to go to a medical doctor, it becomes kind of a in run around the choice of a person who opts not to do that, who chooses not to do that is according to their beliefs. And that would be my concern with this bill as well. I think it goes way too far. I think it creates an incredible reporting system for a whole lot of schools, a whole lot of people. And I was intrigued by Dr. Monsager's, you know, lack of success with some of his patients and things that happen, that we don't impact people very well this way. And I certainly don't want the legislature involved in anything. And I don't care if we have vending machines in the building or not. I never use them. But I just think this is a probably a laudatory goal, but a strange way to go about it. But I would support the witness's desire to have an opt-out provision. Thank you.
Barbara Thompson.
My name is Barbara Thompson. I'm the director of the Division of Teaching and Learning Support with the Department of Education and Early Development. I'm here to speak to the fiscal note that we prepared, and it indicates that the costs related to the bill are indeterminate at this time. We know that we would have to draft and implement a number of regulations related to the collecting of data and reporting of data that the school districts are required to provide under this bill. We just don't know what that will translate into cost-wise. And to speak to the amendment that was proposed, if the language changed to have the Department of Health and Social Services assist the Department of Education in training, then our fiscal note would need to be revised if that language were changed, because we did not build that language change and the effects of that into this fiscal note.
Senator Green.
Does that affect the fiscal note of the department?
It would affect the fiscal note of our department, yes.
And in what way?
It would increase it.
For what reason? What would your function change, or what would the workload difference be?
In the same respect that the Department of Health and Social Services, if the language had stayed the same, where they were training and certifying school personnel to do this, then they would have submitted a large fiscal note. If they are now assisting our department in training, we believe there would be a fiscal note as well.
I misunderstood what you said. I thought were talking about the witness's request for an opt-out provision.
Excuse me.
Okay. But what I would like to say, you know, you said you didn't know how this would be interpreted. I know how this will be interpreted by school districts, and it will be an unfunded mandate.
Correct. We do not know what the costs would be to school districts to implement this. I did want to say one thing. It was mentioned, the doctor mentioned that wellness policies will be developed by schools. It's actually by districts. For those districts participating in school lunch programs, child nutrition programs, so that would affect 49 out of our 53 school districts. We have applied for some federal funding through the U.S. Department of Agriculture in collaboration with the Department of Health and Social Services to assist districts in preparing those wellness plans. It's a competitive grant. We're not sure if we're going to get it, but we just submitted it this week.
Have you been in on the hearings on Representative McGuire's bill on schools doing health wellness plans?
I have not.
Yeah, okay. All right. So Has the department taken a position on this bill?
We haven't taken a formal position. We realize how important the issue is and know that some schools, some districts are trying to look at this issue either through the vending machines or physical education offerings. We're aware that there's another bill out that creates a physical education task force.
Yes.
Correct. That would, I assume, look at issues such as this and try to assist in addressing them. And we also know that districts will be required in the near future to develop wellness plans. And we intend to work with them on those wellness plans because child nutrition programs are a part of our department.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to come and help us. Does anyone else want to testify on this bill? Just two comments from me. I don't see that writing down the height and weight of a kid on a chart is going to be a huge load for a school. And on the issue of unfunded mandates, I might be surprised if schools didn't know already, you know, what the health of their kids or something like. So I don't think feel like it's going out into new and uncharted territory. But you can argue, and I think Senator Elton made the point to Dr. Monsager, that maybe we are trying to put a requirement here, an unrequested requirement, onto the schools, but indeed the overweight kids coming out of the school puts a huge liability on the state that was not, we didn't ask for. So there might be an unfunded mandate from us, but it's in response to an unrequested and unwanted liability to take care of all the health problems about out there. And for those who say, oh, government ought not to ever give us an unfunded mandate, I might say, we'll quit doing that if you quit sending us problems to fix that we didn't ask for, Senator Elton.
Well, I appreciate that, and I agree with it. I would also suggest that the cost question, I mean, I'm not convinced yet there will be an additional cost if, in fact, schools are going to have to respond to mandates from the WIC program. I mean, I think it would be important for this committee to try and make sure that we align what we require with what they require, and if they're going to require it anyway, it may be just a reporting issue instead of a cost issue. With that statement, I have one question of you, and I'm not sure that I'm not sure what the answer is, but in the bill as it affects both schools and the legislature, I mean, the measurement that you're asking for is profit from vending machines, and I'm curious as to whether or not we need to measure profit, which could be affected by a signing bonus, for example, and not just sales from the vending machine, and whether or not we might want to measure, instead of profit, something else, volume or calorie or something.
Or revenue.
So, I mean, and that's just something to reflect about, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, my reference wasn't to the taking a vision of height and weight, because I think they regularly take height and weight as it is now. I don't think that's anything new. It was more in the reporting and the follow-up and the, I think it would be the language contained on, you know, the percentages of the students and, you know, the mathematic thing and
okay.
The preparation of the report. It wasn't the height and the weight, because I think I remember having that done way back when. And now, does a body mass index apply only to the legislature? Or is that something you're going to have for the students as well?
Yeah, my understanding was both.
And then I think that gets into, I maybe need to be corrected, but is body mass index a totally scientific calculation?
Senator Green, through the chair, thank you for that question. BMI, or body mass index, is a screen. It's not a diagnosis, because you've seen data about whether pro football players or pro basketball players, whether they would be obese by BMI standards. So it's a screen that for a lot of kids, most kids given inactivity, is a very accurate screen. But you clearly have well-fit kids that can be big that aren't fat. And so we need to always remember that's all this is this is just an indicator you need to go see your doctor.
This is not a weight displacement test. This is a mathematic calculation.
The calculation is done. It calculates height in meters, weight in kilos, and then there's it's a kilo per meter squared calculation.
Per meter squared?
I think that's where you'll need your training.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
The calculators they've got available now.
Just puts in a number.
Yeah, all right. So is there a better measure that we should use, given what we're trying to do here?
Chairman Dyson, the literature and the scientists today, for the tools we have today, it's the best screen that's available. It's better than height and weight, but it's better than tricep skin folds, which has been used too, but it's not as good as displacement in water, for example.
So I think what I'll do is we will hold this. And we will, when we convene next, we meet on Friday. I'd like to know from all of you if any of you have any objection to this language from the Christian Scientists, which is an opt-out. And was it Beth? Yeah, Beverly. Do you all? Most schools where my kids have gone have said, hey, you got to have these shots because we're really afraid of communicable diseases. Do you guys run into that problem?
There have been, and some states have laws that require it, and others you can be exempted. So it varies from state to state. But
and Barb, maybe you can think about what will the department, you know, think about us including this, and let us know by Friday. Senator Green.
Yeah. Can you? I thought I saw something on here that referred to something about private schools or homeschools, or is there a reference to that says they're exempted? Did I see that, or am I my imagination running away?
Well, I'll have to look.
Okay.
And I'll find out for you.
Thank you.
All right. So, and then to my colleagues in the legislature, if you want to strip out the sections that have to do with the legislature doing this, I will holler a little, but I won't pull the bill because of it. But I thought that it would add to our showing that we're serious if we were willing to subject ourselves to the same standard and so on and so forth. I think it actually would add to what we're trying to do statewide to show that we're willing to expose ourselves to the same thing. Senator Green?
Yeah, I would just like to comment that certainly our state Board of Education could address the issue of physical education at any time they chose, just like they did for Alaska District.
Sure. Well, I thought you were going to suggest that they do their BMIs as well.
You're adults.
Mr. Chair, I mean, it may be necessary. I have to tell you that, you know, perhaps it's a reminder for us also if we're subjected to the same rules we're asking students to be subjected to. And I'd also like to note that I've had 2 glasses of water since Dr. Mansigger's testimony. So I don't usually do that, Doctor.
I think Dr. Munsager is a good example.
Yes, is he ever.
Practices.
I don't want my BMI compared to his. I know that.
Practices what he preaches and is a good example of it. Anything else that the committee would like to have before us when we bring this back on Friday? All right. Dr. Olson, I would, if you haven't looked through this or gone through it with Dr. Munsager, I would encourage you to do so.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure that there is a clear and concise effect on private schools if we don't already have it in the bill.
What do you want for private schools?
I want either somebody to testify from the private sector.
No. Do you want private schools included or not?
That's why I'd like to hear from the private education people, and generally they don't like to be included.
Sorry, tell me what you want again.
I'd like to hear from the private schools as to whether they would want to be included in this bill or not be included in the bill.
So?
If they don't want us to testify, then let's exclude them.
Okay, all right. Anything else on this? All right, we will suspend the hearing on this bill. Now we'll go on to our last order of business today, SB 177. This bill, I think, thank you all, originated with the committee. I did this as a favor. And who do we have on that wants to testify? Yes.
This is Alan Marotti, Fairbanks, Alaska.
Yeah, I've got you here, Alan. Thank you. Stand by for a minute. Ann, are you on board? Ann Henry?
Yes, I am. I'm on board, Senator.
Yeah, Ann, just when we walked in the meeting today, I was handed a letter suggesting that, who's that letter from? Who's the letter from?
Dr. Edney.
The Dr. Edney.
He's the chairman of the Board of Psychological and Psychological Examiner Association.
Yeah, Dr. Edney, chairman of the Psychological Something Board, has suggested that you all work on this to work out these problems here during the interim and that we get back and deal with this after you guys have worked it out. Have you been a part of any of those conversations, Ann?
I actually have spoken with Hello? This is Ann.
Yeah, go ahead, Ann.
Okay. I have spoken with Dr. Andy, and when we communicated before, she said that she would like to add some things, some language to be deleted from their statutes as well as the language that we had suggested. So I don't have a problem with waiting on that. It sort of came upon us all fairly quickly, and we didn't have a chance to talk quite very much in advance of this hearing. So, and I know she's out of town right now, so I'm fine with it if that is the pleasure of the committee.
Yeah, and we're here to do what works for you all. I have Alan Marotti, Dr. David Sandberg, Lauren Bradbury, and Philip Baker online. All of you, I think, have identified yourselves as professionals in this category, except maybe Lauren Bradbury. Do any of you feel that the content of this bill is so timely that we need to proceed now, or as opposed to letting some of you work it out and give us a better product to start with? I'll start with Dr. Sandberg.
Senator Dyson, I am currently president of the Alaska Psychological Association. I'm also a licensed clinical psychologist. And from our perspective, we would be happy to work with the LPCs to create a solution that supports their need, but also protects the public interest better, as well as our profession. And so time to work together would be advantageous.
Thank you, sir. That's a very professional attitude. Lauren Bradbury?
Yeah, this is Dr. Lauren Bradbury. I'm also on the board, on the psychology board. And I would agree with Dr. Sandberg wholeheartedly.
All right. Thank you, sir. And thanks for your time. Philip Baker?
Thank you, Senator Dyson. I'm the political action officer for the Alaska Psychological Association and worked with Dr. Henry to craft this letter for you. I'm very pleased that you have it in your possession. Thank the folks that got you that. Covering political action issues for our association, that's exactly what we were hoping that the committee could give us the opportunity to work with the folks that need these corrections, and so I find no objection and very pleased with this recommendation.
All right, thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Alan Morati?
Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, over to you. What do you think, sir?
Well, I'm a former member of the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors, and I am in support of what Ann Henry has said, taking time to go ahead and work with the psychologists and craft language that will be the best for practice of psychology and counseling in the state.
All right. Is there anyone who feels strongly that we shouldn't let these folks work these things through? And all right. The silence is deafening. Thank you all. If you need assistance from us in any way, let us know.
And Senator Dyson?
Yes.
This is Ann Henry again. I just wanted to make a point of clarification. It was the Mental Health Providers Association that came to me and asked me to work on this bill because they were concerned about it. It wasn't an LPC board-sponsored bill. I mean, we weren't the ones that initiated the action. Just for point of clarification.
Yes. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. And Anne, are you going to be involved in this process?
Yes, I will.
Yeah. I guess I'd enjoy if you'd kind of keep my office updated the progress during the next during the interim.
Yes, I will. And thank you very much for your support.
All right.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Bye bye.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Any other business to come before us today? We're adjourned. How'd it go, sir?